Sounds True presents Experiments in Truth with Ram Dass.
In the early 1960s, Harvard psychology professor Richard Alpert was dismissed from his position because of his controversial research into psychedelic drugs. No longer a part of the Harvard faculty and disillusioned with the short-lived results of his psychedelic experiments, the young Richard Alpert traveled to India on a spiritual quest. During his travels in India, he studied and practiced devotional yoga and met the man who was to become the most important spiritual teacher of his life, Neem Karoli Baba. Neem Karoli Baba, endearingly known as Maharaji, gave Richard Alpert the spiritual name Ram Dass, or Servant of God. In the 3 decades since his return from India, Ram Dass has become one of America's chief interpreters of Eastern spiritual traditions, as well as an outspoken voice for the way of selfless service as a spiritual path. The following series of historic talks were selected from hundreds of lectures Ram Dass has delivered from 1969 to 1995. And now, tape 1 of Experiments in Truth. The Breath Inside the Breath, Part 1. Recorded live in San Rafael, California in 1994 with Ram Dass.
Poem by Rumi. The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They are in each other all along. That last line interesting. The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They are in each other all along. I'm pushing 3 planes. Out of the infinite variety of planes, I'm just pushing 3. One is what we would call the ego plane. That will include the physical, mental, and emotional body. Then we'll call the second one the soul plane, and that will include the way in which you are a somebody awareness. You're still somebody. You are an entity with unique karma. And the third plane is the plane of pure awareness, which is really not a plane, but we'll use the word planes now. We could use spheres, but we'll just use planes. Don't think that planes mean higher is better. They're just different from one another. So if I were to review our storyline thus far from, let's say, the soul's point of view, the middle level, I would say I had some business to do, which we will call karma, some ill-digested attachments, aversions and attractions. And that karma led to the manifestation of me in a physical form. In other words, I took birth in an incarnation. And when I was born, I was still fully out there with my karma to run through, of course. But that karma involved a certain experience of socialization. And in that process, I knew ultimately of my separateness. I experienced my separateness from God or from all or from something. In other words, I began to get attached to the form in which I had manifested. I'm now speaking of the soul. Now, as I get sort of encrusted into a form, there is a kind of a moment of incredible fear when the form starts to solidify enough so there's a boundary, so there is a form and other. There is and other. you pinch your toe and you pinch the bedpost and they're different, and you keep pinching and pinching and pinching and pinching, and you're learning that's me and that's not me, or something like that. Now, it can be as early as when you get born, when you leave the womb. It could be that separation. Or it could be the separation when you first experience sucking and there's no milk coming. That is, when you experience the separateness, so that the universe isn't all one thing anymore. There's an awareness that there's something separate. You have separated. And you have gotten caught in a part of the universe rather than the awareness. You are the whole universe. So you have, what Brigitte talks about, been imprisoned by your own mind in some way. I mean, this is the mind that's done this. Because the hunger was so strong, and it wasn't being fulfilled, and there was pain, and these learnings are very deep when there was an emotional component to them. And most of us got very deeply socialized into being somebody, into our incarnation. When you take an incarnation, it's like getting into a spacesuit, and the whole program for running that spacesuit on this plane of existence, physical, mental, emotional, that whole mechanism is something that is like software in the system, and it has to be developed. And that happens through your DNA code, through your socialization process, through all the people you meet and talk to. But notice an interesting thing, that your whole sense of separateness is really rooted from some uncomfortable experience of being separate. In other words, you didn't jump into separateness as a celebration for the most part. You were kind of pushed into separateness. Maybe you would have jumped a moment later, and maybe you did jump, and that's just the experience you had was one of pushing against it. But you obviously did, and I did. But the other day, when I was thinking back over all of this in my life, I can experience the power of my mother to deliver milk to me and keep me dry and warm and loved. I traced how the separation from my ability to be that, so that I got into separateness, so that I tried to control it. As soon as you become somebody, you get into a power thing, because as a somebody, as a baby, you're awfully little. And the forces around you are very big. And so I somehow experienced in myself, having experienced the pain of separateness and having not the power to control that, that I couldn't get what I wanted when I wanted it, once I became a somebody who wanted something. And I only became a somebody who wanted something because I didn't have what I wanted all the time. I hadn't even had a want up until then. I had to learn wants, by the way. And really, most of my life, from all my education, because these were all surrogates for that power person that held the control of my being, I developed, as you did, incredible skills of looking into other people's eyes to know who you were. Am I good? Am I enough? Am I achieving? Am I successful? Am I beautiful? Am I fulfilling? Am I attractive? Am I smart enough? Whatever judgmental thing you imposed on yourself, and I am myself. And I kept trying to be satisfied all the time through various things. But notice how all of it, all of my separateness was built on relationship. My relationship with my mother, with my father, with my surrogates, with all of the things that then became so on. And how much the whole web of what I call my ego is basically relational. I guess I would have continued to be that somebody, having then been trained, as you know, in somebody's specialness, just like you were. So we aren't just somebody, we're somebody special. And then we all go around being somebody special, and we form relationships based on our specialness and their specialness, and we look for symbiosis around our specialness. And it's all very dramatic. It's all as the world turns, and it's all so poignantly, beautifully horrible and so thick, and everybody's in it right up to their eyeballs. And does she, does he, will they, won't they, can I, can't I, what will we think if I do, oh, yeah, yeah, hello, goodbye, I miss you, I love you, go away. It's all relational stuff. Just look at your language, your concepts, all of it. It's so thick. You keep saying, I want to be alone. Don't kid yourself. You don't want to be alone. You wouldn't exist. Funny way, you only exist relationally at that level. The funny thing about the ego, how deeply it is in relationships, and that's why I got interested in what happened in the 60s, when a certain thing culminated that was kind of bubbling around in the history of the culture, which was the undivided loyalty to individualism. After fascism and communism, we got into individualism. Newism. What's in it for me? Am I growing? Who am I? What do I need? What do I want? What do I desire? Almost a worship of our somebodyness. I have a right to be somebody. And that came out of years of feeling you didn't. Of carrying around the feeling I'm powerless and something I'm wrong because I'm not the whole universe like I used to be, which you experienced as a baby. It's been incredibly painful. The moment not just of physical birth, but of psychological birth, of the experience of separateness as an entity when you have been the whole thing. I've described in many lectures the experience in Hawaii with that community of meditators where finally they had pushed me to my limits and they all had their hands on my body and I was screaming and screaming and screaming as to their orders. And suddenly I was back in a crib in my room at home and I was screaming the same way. And my mother was holding me down, just had her hand on my chest. And the look was the look of, I don't know what the look was. That would be projecting. All it was the experience of loss of power. I was having a temper tantrum, obviously, of some sort. And she was just being a good mother. She wasn't giving way to it. She wasn't reinforcing temper tantrums, which you didn't do in those days. Later you did. And look what happened. But she didn't, and she wasn't out of a, like, I'm a mean mother. She was just calming me down, but it was firm. And the firmness had a resistance to my power. I couldn't control the situation anymore. And the experience was one of loss of power. And when I see, when I look at business, and I look at government, and I look into the personalities of all of the politicians, and don't you see all that fear and don't you see all that sense of not being powerful enough? And if I had the power, it would all be all right. We are caught in a drama so thick of ego, ego structures, ego constructs that have come out of our intellectual extrapolations from our basic root conceptual models of who am I and how the world works. Which has to do with fear, it has to do with feelings of pain of separateness, it has to do with power. It has to do with a yearning to come back to a certain feeling at home in the universe, at home, at one. And I think most of what we live with in politics, in business, in most of our professions, most of our lifestyles, deeply, deeply, deeply emerged in these particular conceptual plane of reality that everybody conspires to see as real. And with aging, it's absolutely amazing how this society conspires to define what aging is and then sucks everybody into believing it's true and then they live it out. And it's a hype. It is a complete hype. It's a creation of mind. So that if you look at aging in almost all the literature, it is seen as a problem. That's the first one. Isn't that bizarre? You know, it's like the leaves turn red in the fall, and you say, we got a problem. Let's get out there with a green can and paint them all green. What the hell? We can't have these leaves turning red. What's that about? It's so absolutely bizarre. Bizarre. The first thing you have to realize is you're in prison. You've been had. You bought into a conceptual model that you got trained into from birth to deal with your separateness, and it's a whole structure that you've invested with reality. And from your point of view, it's the only reality most of the time. When my father would say, Richard, come back to reality, that's the one he meant. Now, where are all the other planes of reality when they're so busy investing in this one rather uninteresting plane? It's not uninteresting. It's actually passionately beautiful, but it's also uninteresting. If it's your only one, it's like not having cable. But the minute you realize you are in prison, that's the relative reality perception. You realize you've got a problem. You realize there's more than one channel. You realize there's another place from which to look. However you want to say it, you understand the theory of relativity. You understand that everything is real depending on where you're looking at it from. Just like you dreamt last night, and in that dream, that stuff was real. And you woke up, and then you said, I woke up. Into what? I mean, you ultimately must realize you just woke up into another one of them. And once I had realized that I was in prison, which is what my first mushroom trip absolutely ascertained for me with certainty, or as certain as relative reality can get, I looked back at all the years in which I had taken it all so, quote, seriously. And I thought, did I have any clues, any of those years? I mean, did I go 30 years without a clue that I was caught in some weird group psychosis? At that time, I didn't quite see it. Over the years, I began to see that as my vision of where I was looking from changed, then a number of things that had been in the background in my life started to come out as figure. And things that were figures started to recede in the background, and suddenly I could see that there was a web of that information and that wisdom available, but I was busy not seeing it because of the intense nature of the plane I was seeing. The interesting example of that predicament was the one in which my guru said to me on the second time I saw him, your mother is a great saint. And I said, didn't Maharaji say was a great saint? And the translator asked Maharaji, Maharaji said, no, is a great saint. And she was dead, so she was a dead great saint. So what was that? And what I experienced at the moment he said that was the realization that my mother wasn't who I had thought she was, that I had trapped her in being that Jewish middle class, nurturing, very responsible mother. And that was just who she had incarnated as. And he was saying, she's a great being. And suddenly, at that moment, there was a reversal. And the very few, maybe four or five times in our life that I could remember, when there had been that reversal and where we had recognized one another as fellow beings. One example is she and I were coming back from the dentist. I was maybe nine or so. And we came to a stoplight and we were playing a game to see who could hold a note the longest. And we were both screaming at the top of our lungs. And we looked over and there was a man in the next car looking at us as if we were both completely insane. And there was a moment when our whole game of mother and child dissolved into the hate of the moment. And at that moment, we were outside of our roles for a moment and then back in. And those were so few, and yet they had existed. And it's interesting, after he said that, ever after, That's who she and I have been with one another. And all that other stuff has disappeared or dissolved into the ground. And it's why I say to people when they're grieving, you're grieving for all the forms of the incarnation. But why you're grieving is because you connected with love to the deeper nature of the other person. And when you stop filling your mind with your self-pity, anger, hope, fear, wishing, da-da-da, and quiet, you experience nothing happened. Nobody went anywhere. It is merely because I've measured you in terms of your forms. I've reduced you into form. And now you're dead and you up-leveled me. You said, find me now. Go ahead. You really love me? Find me. And you keep wanting the form back, because that's the one that turns you on. But ultimately, you have to turn on from somewhere else. Otherwise, you're always desperate for external rushes. So an awakening could be said to be the moment when you realize you're in prison. The moment when you experience another reality. The moment when you see there are other ways of looking at it all. I mean, really other. Really other. I'm not talking about other places in your thought process, but other. Now, what you call that place from which you look at your life when before you were just busy thinking you were it, your incarnation life, where do you look at it from? And that's where we're using the word soul, which could, at the deepest levels of the use of the word witness, could be that, but usually it isn't. Now, let's look at the soul's predicament. The soul had some karma to work out, took an incarnation, got lost in the incarnation, and then starts to awaken and realize that it has just taken an incarnation. And it had to get lost and go through the whole process of awakening for the incarnation to work out the karma. This is not an error in the system. The predicament with the word soul is that it's got all kinds of Christian overlay. I guess it's got Jewish overlay and probably every other religious overlay, too. I don't mean to lay it on the Christians. And actually, that's because that plane is a wonderful leverage plane to see the plane you've been stuck on. It's a very useful plane. It's like a step in a ladder, and it allows you to take your pressure off your foot on the lower rung because you're on the middle rung. So that you could say that one of the ways of awakening is you awaken to realize you are a soul that has been lost for quite a while in an incarnation, which you created, or which is the manifest of what your karma needs. It's all fine. There's no errors. It's just interesting. Oh, my God, have I been had? I'm not that being at all. And the experience of the awakening of the soul, which is not just the awakening, because with my mother and all, we were awakening into that place of just being two beings sharing the peculiarity of the predicament we found ourselves in as incarnate. As Golem said, what are we doing here where this is real? What are we doing stuck in this place where it's real? That's the lazy man's guide to enlightenment. So from the soul's point of view, as you start to awaken, you see the way in which the incarnation sticks to you as you're sort of shaking it off, like shaking off water or stuff like that. Now, there's a tendency, because you've been trapped in the incarnation for so long, when you awaken, to see it in negative terms. It trapped me, it's thick, it's heavy, it's something, and you push against it. It's like the renunciate path. I just won't think of rhinoceros, you know. I just will push away life. I will push away incarnation, and then I will soar as a soul. In other words, I want to get high, and I want to push away the low. And low and high are still seen as value things, that higher is better than lower. Higher I feel connected to the universe, I feel I'm in my soul. Lower, I come down back into my psychodynamic, social, physical, somebody's specialness. trapped back here again. From the soul's point of view, the curriculum of the soul has two components to it. They're really interesting. The middle level, remember now. First of all, it's working with its incarnation. And it sees, ultimately, that Buddha was absolutely right on. That the clinging of mind, the attraction and the aversions of mind, are what juice the whole system and the suffering and the whole shtick. So the soul is using the experiences of incarnation to get lost in, then to awaken out of, to see one's predicament, and to get to the point where one can be, as Christ said, in the world but not of the world. You are not pushing away your incarnation because that's an aversion. And you can't afford any aversions anymore. Because aversions are from the ego level. The soul doesn't have aversions. The soul just sees aversions and attractions within the ego. Every time you're identified with an attraction or an aversion, you're identified with your ego. So the job of extricating oneself into one's soul is slowly cultivating those qualities which allow you to see the whole process and to calm yourself into realizing that your incarnation is about extricating yourself from attractions and aversions so that you are not lost in incarnation anymore. But it doesn't mean pushing against it, as you soon find out in the horny celibate period. Because if you push against it, it still got you. The game is to go beyond that into the point where you are fully in the world and fully not in the world. There are stages where you get into your soul where you say, oh, I miss the passions of life. Meaning the passions, the excitements that were caused by being lost in it. And you think, I'll never have those again. I'll never have my first romance. I'll never have this and I'll never have that. Because those were so adrenaline rushy, heady stuff. And that's a lot like what is often called the dark night of the soul, where you have sort of realized that you're not going to have the intensity of the excitement that came from being totally lost into the linear drama and not knowing how it comes out. It all comes out the same. It all turns back into whatever it is. That's the transitory nature of phenomena, whether you like it or not. The soul is unique. It has its unique karma. It's working it out through incarnation. As it awakens to its own existence, it starts to shed the attractions and the aversions that had it stuck and closed down into the prison of incarnation. It awakens, so now the soul is present, and the incarnation is unfolding. Its storyline is continuing. Ram Dass is continuing. Its story goes on. Hello, how are you? Yes, I'll do that. Hello. Good evening, this is Ram Dass. That's all the storyline. And slowly, more and more, behind it is just, wow, look at that one. Mild curiosity at first. That's a subtle attachment. Fascination. You wouldn't have believed that, would you? The synchronicity is appalling. And then you get to the point of, and then the point of it's all precious. See, you can't experience the all precious, beautiful, yum, yum, yum of the beloved as long as you're afraid of being trapped by it. You've got to get through your original reaction to the trauma of what you've been through, of being trapped. When the soul wakes up, it's like, it's very shaky. Very shaky. It isn't, of course, but it thinks it's shaky. So now when somebody says, I have a special relationship with you, the question is, do souls have special relationships? Egos certainly do. Souls are working out their stuff through ego special relationships. But the question is, do you want to identify with a special relationship or do you want to identify with a soul? And if it's a soul, we just, you here, I'm here, hi. Well, what have we got to do? Well, this time we'll just wave. No, this time you be my father and I'll be your child. No, this time let's be competitors. Okay. Like when the Dalai Lama was asked what he thought of the Big Bang Theory, he said, which one? And the mature relationships that we develop when you work on yourself deeply enough, and you meet another person who is working on themselves deeply enough, is we meet just as you here, I'm here. And then if we have a dance to do, we dance. And if we don't have a dance to do, we don't dance. But the dance or the not dance doesn't matter to either of us. And yet we love each other deeply. Deeply. By really playing with different ones of you in these different ways as if it really matters. But it's much more fun if you also realize it doesn't matter. Much more fun. The game is much higher. And I keep saying, hey, play it a different way. Come on out. It's like having a ball bouncing outside at sunset, and everybody's got their nose pressed against the window saying, we can't come out. Mother said it's too late. We can't come out. And I'm just waiting for someone to come out and play. And most of you, we play for moments, and then people go back into stuff. And I go back into stuff, and that's our work, is to extricate ourselves from having to look at how we are with each other as egos rather than as souls. And I think it's a confusion, the term soulmate. I mean, I can understand it. I can see souls traveling together through series of incarnations because they have work to do. Most of the people that use the word soulmate do it from an ego level. And there's a whole way of describing spiritual planes from ego. It is really basically ego stuff. A lot of the New Age movement is that. It is basically an ego ripoff of spiritual concepts by people who still want power because they are rooted in fear. Soul isn't rooted in fear. The soul is doing fine. And when Maharaji said to me, Ramdas, don't you see it's all perfect? He was saying, hey, couldn't you come up for air for a second? You know, couldn't you come up and play a little bit? And I'm saying, no, it's real. Damn it, it's wrong. It's bad. There's good and there's evil, and this is evil. And he's saying, we'll wait. You know. He's flipping through the deck of incarnations and seeing about 100,000 incarnations down the line. I will say, oh, God, you were high. But he's in no rush. Where's he going to go? I mean, when souls look at people who are busy being egos, just realize how poignant it all looks. How poignant it all looks. But you love the soul and the storyline is so poignant. But my storyline's poignant. My storyline's no more interesting to me than yours is to me. It's all vitally interesting. It is, and it's all empty. I'll give you vital if you'll allow empty. If you don't buy empty, you can't have vital. See, if you don't understand what I'm saying, you've got two choices. Either I'm insane or you are. And I haven't the faintest idea. I wish I could help you. Because it seems real to me, what I'm saying to you. So good luck. The fun is that when the hubbub and clamor of ego entrapment gets lightened. And I mean lightened so that you're not pushing against it, but so you're really in it, but you're not caught in it. like taking care of my father through the last years, was going from being caught and doing it from one level, which was ego level, slowly to extricating until we were sold, just completing the business of ego and incarnation together. So as it gets lighter, not through avoidance, but lighter through harmoniously fulfilling one's dharma, fulfilling one's stuff on earth, doing what your thing is, hearing your uniqueness and manifesting, just not getting caught in it. As you get lighter into all of that, then the soul's initial business comes to light, which is its relationship to the one, or to the non-book, no words, what the finger's pointing at. It's the mystery. The relation of the soul to the mystery. And that ultimately is the only game in town. And that's the language of the beloved. That's the language of the mystic poetry. It's the language of the soul yearning to be with God, to be in God, to be one with what is, to be beyond boundary, to ultimately rend the strings that keep a boundary between something and something else. In other words, it's to become in love, which is boundaryless. It is to die into love. And what's happened, if you notice the sequence, is you went from one into soul, soul took birth into separate caughtness, separateness awakes to soul, and then when soul is in harmony, got its act together, then soul's yearning for the coming back out of its own ultimate separateness created by the karmic structure of it all, then it starts to come back into the one. And that yearning is the call towards the beloved. And these words from Ananda Mayama, beautiful, beautiful, great woman saint. She said, this body has lived with father, mother, husband, and all. This body has served the husband, so you may call it a wife. It has prepared dishes for all, so you may call it a cook. It has done all sorts of scrubbing and menial work, so you may call it a servant. But if you look at the thing from another standpoint, you will realize that this body has served none but God. But when I serve my father, mother, husband, and others, I simply consider them as different manifestations of the Almighty and serve them as such. When I sat down to prepare food, I did so as if for God. Whenever I did in a spirit of divine service. Hence, I was not quite worldly, though always engaged in household affairs. I had but one ideal, to serve all as God, to do everything for the sake of God. Now, can you hear? There's the whole ego storyline going. Bengali woman, wife, does it all. But she's on the level of soul, doing her life as an offering to bring her to the beloved. When Hanuman is with Ram, and Ram says to Hanuman, who are you, Hanuman? And Hanuman says, when I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I know who I am you. Okay? Now we're talking about the second and the third planes that I'm asking you to consider. The second plane is the soul. And you and I are fellow souls that have taken incarnation with our storylines coming from distances, all of our life stuff. And we're meeting each other through our psyches and personalities and stuff. But behind it, we're laughing. Ah, what happened to you this trip? Well, I really have. You should have seen. My God, what happened in my childhood, you wouldn't believe. I've been milking it for 30 years. I'm a fierce player, by the way. Don't make friends with an elephant trainer unless you have room for an elephant in your living room. That's a great Hindu line. Are you looking for me? I am in the next seat. My shoulder is against yours. You will not find me in stupas, nor in Indian shrine rooms, nor in synagogues, nor in cathedrals, not in masses, nor kirtans, nor in legs winding around your neck, nor in eating nothing but vegetables. When you really look for me, you will see me instantly. You will find me in the tiniest hour of time. Kabir says, students, tell me, what is God? God is the breath inside the breath. And so the predicament between the second and third planes that I'm asking you to consider is that the second has this intense yearning to merge back into the beloved. And as that merging occurs, the next surrender, the next death, if you will, it's not a ripping, it's just a movement into. There is the realization that God has been all of it all along. That final plane is something that includes everything, it excludes nothing. You could call that third plane awareness. Awareness. See, go back inside yourself and you sit down so that the trauma of your ego story quiets down just a little bit. And then you begin to feel the awareness, the presence of soul, which is still you and unique. And you're seeing your life unfold. You're seeing your clings, your shadows, your loves, your passions. You're seeing it all. You're bringing mindfulness to what is in the incarnation. And if you keep going and saying, but who's that? Who's not? Who am I? What is? Then even the sense of a separate entity turns out to just be more phenomena. You're even thinking of yourself as separate, finally dissolves. And you are indeed back where you started. It would be one way of saying it, although that implies start and back and beginning and end. You've been there all along. That's the bizarre thing. The realization you've been here all the way along. It was like I had a dream and I awoke. Oh! The dream was that I was separate. Even as a soul. And then that soul and its separateness all comes into awareness, but as phenomena. As phenomena. And at that moment, you start to appreciate, if you go inward, you begin to appreciate how awareness is awareness. It's not your awareness. It's not my awareness. It's nothing personal. And when you and I rest in awareness, that is the culmination of love. Because you're not even a breath apart. You are the breath within the breath. Breath within the breath. When people say, may peace be with you, peace cannot be with the ego, except like for the briefest second. The ego is made up of stuff that doesn't allow for it. The soul is still moving towards something. Awareness is peace. And phenomena align. I am a phenomenon in your consciousness at this moment. Just another moment. Just another moment. I guarantee you that within 10 hours this will be going. And there'll be even the memory of it gone. It'll come back, but it'll be gone. You'll be so busy getting supper that just in cutting the beans, this moment will be gone. Where was it? Oh, I'll never forget this. I hope you will. because awareness is in the moment. It's not in moldering butterflies of memories of awareness. It's in the moment. It's so bizarre as we keep playing with it, how you can go through time into timelessness. You can go through becoming into being. You can go in through meditation of planes of consciousness, of the witness and the deeper witness and the witness of the witness, and back in until there's just and all of that keeps going in and out and in and out and in and out. And that's an interesting one. Does it ever be all in at the same moment? I don't really know that. Because the way we see manifestations is always from one plane or another. Like the other quote of Ananda Maima, are the words on one plane speaking about another plane. It's the finger pointing at the moon. And once Paramahansa Yogananda asked Ananda Maima to tell him something of her life. Father, she said, there is little to tell. My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on earth, Father, I was the same. I grew into womanhood, but still I was the same. When the family in which I had been born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. And Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Even afterwards, though the dance of creation changes around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same. Can you hear who that is? It's you. That's peace. Do you hear that? That's equanimity. That's peace. Just the same. Loss, gain, fame, shame, pleasure, pain, life, death. Look. Same. Boy, did you see that world end heavy, wasn't it? I'm challenging you now to get all three planes going so that you are honoring the ego and you're playing your part and you're in your role and you're doing it all perfectly. The soul that is running off its karmic tab, well, there goes abuse. There's financial dismal failure. That's it. I needed one of those to fill in that square. That's it. Soul's running off its karma. Interesting. Fascinating. Ah. And then at the same moment, it's got the yearning, that yearning. But the other part of the soul's business is its relationship to the One. And for the One, there is the play of all this stuff going on within itself. It's all an internal matter. Just souls, egos, stories, planes of consciousness, all within awareness. When you start to work with that ultimate plane, the kinds of lines you use are this five-line stanza from a Tibetan woman. Don't prolong the past. That's your personal history, by the way. Don't invite the future. How do you know how it's going to come out? Don't alter your innate wakefulness. You don't have to do anything. Just be. Don't fear appearances. Phenomena come up, including your actions. It's all phenomena. Nothing more than that. This is a quote from a chapter called Naturally Liberating Whatever You Meet in something called The Crystal Cave. On the one hand, when you regard disturbing emotions as emptiness, your practice turns into taking emptiness as the path and not the disturbing emotions. Thus, your practice doesn't become the short path. On the other hand, if you indulge in the disturbing emotions, thinking they are something concrete, it's like eating a poisonous plant and is the cause which binds you to samsara. Any disturbing emotion that may arise is wisdom the moment you relax to your natural mind. Look directly into it. Don't deliberately reject it, regard it as a fault, indulge in it concretely, or regard it as a virtue. The more I live my life tuning to Dharma, certain words come through very strongly, like the word balance and the word patience. I see myself going through life in which phenomena appear, and some of them captivate me immensely, and my awareness goes into a thought relationship to that particular phenomenon. And at that moment, I lose some balance. I lose the spacious round in which that phenomena exists. And then sometimes I keep letting go of thoughts, letting go of thoughts, letting go of thoughts, until there is just awareness. And resting in that, you lose the world. But I experience my life as a dance of balancing, of cultivating the qualities of spaciousness, of equanimity, of peace, of happiness. But I noticed that there were certain stages in my development, and they're still going on, and it's left over and away from my renunciate models, where I haven't yet fully re-entered into the passions of life because I'm afraid of them, because I'm afraid they will captivate my consciousness and take me away from my balance too much. And I realize you shouldn't be afraid of anything. I agree. But I am afraid. And I see myself getting closer and closer to the edge of my fear of coming back into some passionate joy about something in the world, something I would have been afraid to do for fear of losing my quiet spaciousness, and realizing that now my quiet spaciousness is still present, but it's still empty, clear, quiet. I was doing interviews. I'm doing one interview about every 6 or 7 minutes. Now, many people come for an interview, prepare, they spend time thinking, what will they say? And they get it down to the kernel of the essence of the neurosis, or the kernel of the essence of the drama, the pain, confusion. And they hand me the kernel with all of its juice. And it's our kernel, it's our juice, it's our stuff. And it's my stuff as well as their stuff. I mean, it's just us, kids here. And I watch, because my job in that position, and my job in life, but that position demands it, is that I keep that balance perfectly. That at that moment, if I don't open my heart to the fullness of what that individual's pain or essence problem is, what they experience is that I'm not hearing them, that I don't understand, that they're alone inside their predicament. Because I didn't allow my empathy, the passions that my empathy would engage, I didn't allow it to occur. So I open myself, and sometimes my heart breaks because a person's predicament is a heartbreaker. But then the other part of me is constantly coming back into just awareness, just that presence, that looks at the emotional state, works with them, doesn't push them, doesn't pull them, doesn't grab them. And that part of me becomes a mirror for the other person, for them to see the way in which they're caught. In other words, the two bits of information that my presence there is offering is one, the empathy, we're all in this together. And the other is, but we don't need to be caught. This is two bits of information. And I realize now more and more that what we offer each other as human beings is an environment. And what that is doing is keeping me in the environment of that balance. So that I'm in an environment where if that other person wants to come out and play from the pain and the suffering, here I am. And if they're in the pain and suffering, here I am. But there's nothing in me that's keeping them stuck in the pain and suffering. And there's nothing in me demanding they come out. And that's the interesting one. The interesting one about your morality regarding other human beings' consciousness. Tim and I wrote an article back in 1963 for the Harvard Review called The Politics of Consciousness, in which we are arguing that each individual should have a right to do with their consciousness as they choose. And that's what a free system should allow. Amazing how we don't do that in our society. And of course, it was around psychedelics at that time. But now I can see it. I see it particularly, for example, in the way in working with people that are approaching death. Because there is such a desire in somebody that is on a path of Dharma to have that other person die your death. Die the death you think they should die for them to be liberated. And to me, I've learned over the years, one is it doesn't work. Because when you push against somebody, even the subtlest model in your head, they should be different than they are, awakens in them at a very unconscious level, pushing back. And I have noticed in my human relationships that as I want less and less from each individual, there is much less paranoia in them at a deep level, and they are much more available immediately. And the interesting thing is, what does it mean to be a safe space for another human being? A safe space means you don't have an agenda. But we have this tendency to have a model because we're trying to justify the way we're living our lives. So to me, that word balance is a really key issue. I mean, there are so many little balances we work with. The balance between the kind of intuitive heart and the thinking mind. As you get too much thinking, the energy goes up and there's a whole contraction in the system around thinking. And there's a tendency in the spiritual journey to denigrate thinking, to denigrate intellect, to denigrate analytic mind. And I think that we as Westerners, coming out of our history of having the intellect be the highest power that we have, and now as we're shifting the balance, it is important that we don't throw out the baby with the bath. And I think we are inclined to learn how to integrate these two things so that we can honor and delight in the beauty of the intellect without being trapped by it. As they say, the ego or the analytic mind is a beautiful servant and it's a lousy master. And you can sense as you look at the world conditions how the best of intellect don't solve our problems ultimately. Because our problems require a different level of wisdom. And we have worshipped knowledge rather than wisdom. And wisdom has in it a very deep compassion. Maharaji said, see everyone as God. The reason I'm saying all this is because you and I spend a huge amount of time in interpersonal relations. And the question I ask you, since you and I aren't going to monasteries to live our lives, since that's one of the things we do so much, wouldn't it be nice to make your human relationships the vehicle for becoming free rather than the vehicle to stay entrapped? And what is required is a shift in the way in which one looks at relationships, what they're about, what their function is. We have come out of a psychological morass